Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of Audacious Aotearoa. This is your host Christopher Carroll, and this week I'm going to be interviewing Professor Thomas Preston from Washington State University. He is a specialist in foreign policy decision making as well as political psychology, and we're going to be discussing roles within the White House, the decision making process of past presidents compared to former President Donald Trump, and how the Biden administration is likely to navigate foreign policy challenges going forward. Let's hear from our expert for today. Okay, Professor Thomas Preston, thank you so much for joining us today on Audacious Aotearoa.
Oh, kia ora, Christopher. It's wonderful to be here with you this morning.
First question. Some accounts of Trump's decision-making process and foreign policy suggest he is erratic, indecisive, and at times focused on personal relationships with world leaders rather than outcomes. How distinct is this behavior from past presidents like Nixon, Johnson, and Reagan?
Well, presidents all have their own personalities, obviously, and Trump is sort of stands out as being particularly interpersonally focused, primarily because he has such a high level of insecurity, and so he's very much having to have that adoration. He wants that, and he's almost totally uninterested in accomplishing tasks. So that sets him apart from a lot of presidents. Of the ones you mentioned, you know, I think Ronald Reagan might be the closest, because Reagan never focused on the details of policy. He delegated that to his staff, and he was much more focused on the interpersonal. Now, Nixon and Johnson, people like that, they were much more task-oriented, much more, I mean, yeah, Johnson would work, you know, you've heard of the Johnson treatment, where he would really work on somebody interpersonally. But Johnson was only interested in gathering that information to help him accomplish a task. He wasn't doing it to try to build a relationship with you. And Nixon, of course, was not really very interpersonally focused at all. He was very much wanting to accomplish tasks. So those guys are very different from Trump. And really, you know, I think Trump kind of stands out in a lot of respects from previous presidents. We haven't had anybody quite like him in the past.
Yeah, because I mean, the other thing that comes across from the accounts I've been reading too is that you've got different people involved with the White House taking different approaches when it comes to foreign policy matters. Like the National Security Advisor would be assigned to go off and sort out one thing, but then the Secretary of State would be completely occupied with another, and there's no sort of cross-checking between the different staff within the White House. As though different people were occupied, there was a delegation there, but there was no sort of like check on each other, and there was no sort of like who's making the final decision.
It was a real problem in the Trump administration, primarily because literally you had somebody who didn't have their hands on the steering wheel as the car of state was driving down the road, and so all of the people that were in cabinet positions or heads of agencies or departments just basically were kind of on their own. They came in with certain ideologies, but they were not really being guided by the White House that much. And then, of course, you had some people in there who were, you know, James Mattis, General Mattis, who was the first Secretary of Defense. I mean, he came in and was basically kind of seen as, well, at least there's an adult in the room, you know, and he was trying to steady the situation. So was McMaster when he was NSC advisor. But you know, part of the problem is you just had mixed messages going on and everybody kind of pursuing their own path, which isn't very helpful when you're trying to have some sort of a consistent policy message. You know, if you're trying to communicate with North Korea or Iran or whoever you're trying to communicate with, it doesn't help when the National Security Advisor is saying one thing and the State Department Secretary of State is saying something different and DOD is saying something different. It led to a lot of confusion. I think you saw that overseas a lot, and just in interactions I had when I was in Europe at some NATO conferences, you know, I was talking to ambassadors from other countries, and they were kind of like, we don't know who to listen to. We don't know who to pay attention to. Because, and then of course, Trump, you know, just whatever would pop into his head or on a Twitter feed. And usually that was totally different from what we were doing policy-wise as well. So it was very inconsistent. I think we haven't seen that level of inconsistency. It's very typical of presidencies when you have somebody who delegates and who is kind of very hands-off in their style, which is what Trump was, that you have a lot of bureaucratic politics and a lot of, kind of confusion in that way. But it was even more so in this past administration. So you'll see a totally different dynamic with the new Biden administration, because these are all veterans. They've worked in these positions. Many times they were the deputies, like Anthony Blinken, who's the new Secretary of State. Well, he was Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration. So, and that's very typical. You see a lot of these people who were just at the deputy principal level, now becoming principals now in this administration. So and they know the importance of coordination.
Let's talk about Blinken for a moment, because how significant is it that Biden's Secretary of State was involved heavily with the Iran deal? And then I'm curious as well as to whether there's going to be a salvage when it comes to the Iran deal, whether there's going to be some sort of quid pro quo type situation where diplomats sit down and say, well, if you do this, then we're going to do that. What likelihood do you think that the current Secretary of State will be able to establish something when it comes to Iran?
Well, I mean, I think it's significant in that, Biden selected Blinken because he knew him, he was comfortable working with him. And Biden wants to reengage with the international community. He wants to rebuild the relationships with allies that were very, very heavily damaged during the last administration. And the Iran deal is one of those things which Biden and many others in the foreign policy establishment felt it was a mistake to walk away from the deal. As far as can you avoid Republican blowback for trying to reinstate it? Well, no, of course not, because they were never evaluating the treaty or the policy based upon its merits. They were only playing politics with it. And that's kind of where, so they're going to do that anyway. And I think for the Biden administration, and this is kind of across the board, whether you're talking foreign or domestic policy, I think the key is going to be just focusing upon doing good policy, doing the right thing, and just letting the chips fall where they may. Because you're never going to, if your goal is to make the Republicans happy, well, that's that's kind of a waste of time. But I think that there are some pathways forward. I think the biggest problem with the Iran deal has always been that, you can only address certain things in an agreement. Like this was purposefully limited to focus on the Iran development of nuclear capabilities. Okay. And the deal was very effective, and the Iranians were living up to the agreement until Trump backed out of it. But that was verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency and many other European inspectors and others. So as long as we go into it with realistically and not playing politics, and I know I'm a policy person, so I'm not playing the politics here. I'm just saying, here we're just trying to accomplish this thing with Iran to limit their development of a nuclear weapons program. The agreement was never meant to include missiles. It was never meant to include Iranian activities in Yemen or all these things. Now, are those issues that we will want to pursue? Sure. But I think you have to do those separately. And, this is a lesson that Nixon learned with Kissinger during detente. There was a problem with what was called linkage. They kept trying to link unrelated things to, like an arms agreement. Well, you have to give me a human rights concession or these other things like that. And linkage was one of the reasons detente failed and why some of these agreements didn't succeed as they could have done. So I think the danger is that people who are wanting to include everything are being unrealistic in trying to create linkage. And I think it'd be much better to focus on, the biggest problem is the nuclear issue. So let's deal with that. And then we'll come back and deal with these other side issues, when you build up some trust, because, you're going to have to build up some sort of a relationship with the Iranians. You can't expect them to just fall over themselves to agree with you. And this is the problem we've had with North Korean relations, because we come in demanding, you know, essentially the North Korean unilateral capitulation on the nuclear question. You have to disarm and denuclearize first before we'll negotiate with you. Well, if you're going to take that approach, you might as well waste your time and not waste your time and not engage, because that's a non-starter from the get-go, right?
Looking back at Biden's term as vice president, what do you think that tells us about his potential leadership style now that he's president?
Well, I mean, the impact of roles, I mean, you're talking about like the vice presidential role as opposed to his role when he was in the Senate, because he had a role there too. So there's leaders always are kind of within a certain context. It's almost like actors playing on a particular stage, and the stage is set up to allow certain performances, right? And so, you know, what I tended to, I mean, in my, when I do leadership analysis, and I, you know, I'm a profiler, so I develop personality profiles of leaders, and I've done a lot of work on this and presidents throughout the past. And what I found is that the roles are really things that constrain behavior. So, you know, obviously Biden was limited in the things necessarily he could do as vice president, but some of the most important characteristics are things that are transportable from one role to another. So, you know, I think just talking about Biden more generally, I mean, he's somebody who we in political psychology would call somebody who is high complexity. In other words, they're somebody who sees the shades of gray. They aren't black and white thinkers. Black and white thinkers are ones saying, like, you're either with us or against us. It's right or wrong, true or false. Trump was like that. Okay. W. Bush was like that too, you know. But people who see the shades of gray are willing to, you know, they're not as ideological, they're not as rigid, they're willing to, you know, consider evidence. And what you tend to see with leaders like that is these higher complexity leaders value information more. And they tend to have their antennae up, and they're receiving, they're monitoring the environment. They tend to bring in advisors that will not just be yes men, that actually, you know, they're okay with dissent. They're okay with back and forth. They're interested in the details of information. And I mean, John Kennedy is a good example. I mean, if you were advisors around John Kennedy and everybody was agreeing with him, it made John Kennedy incredibly uncomfortable, to the point where he would go out and set up a red team just to argue the other point, or he would reach out to other places to get arguments against the view, because, you know, he didn't want just yes men. And I think Biden is very much like that. Biden is very, very likes information, gathers information. He's not afraid of dissent. He's not afraid of different views, you know, and he's very knowledgeable policy-wise. So in foreign policy, he's going to be much more engaged because he was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I mean, he has a long background in foreign affairs. So, you know, very much, I mean, he even reads his presidential daily briefs that the intel community give him, which, you know, Trump never did or hardly ever did. And, you know, Trump never wanted information. He never wanted details. He only wanted people around him that agreed with him. So you can see a huge difference there. Biden worked well with Obama because Obama was high complexity too and loved information and was willing to accept dissent. You know, I mean, he brought how many former opponents in the presidential race into the administration, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and others. So I think you'll see Biden continue that pattern. And he'll make better use of like the National Security Council and advisors. He'll use the staffs and the information coming in, which were pretty much ignored in the previous administration. So I think you'll see a lot better policymaking. And, you know, the thing about that, I mean, I think the main difference you see between Obama and Biden, just in terms of personality, is Obama was much more task-oriented, which might surprise you, but he, you know, he could be personable, and it's not, it doesn't have to be absolute one or the other, but, you know, he was interpersonal, but he was much more focused on task accomplishment, you know, and so, Sometimes he would neglect the interpersonal, like he didn't go out and communicate with the public as much to sell the policies as he should have done because he was so focused on the task. Biden, on the other hand, is much more interpersonally focused. I mean, he's interested in task, but he's much more interpersonally focused. And Biden has this reputation of being very heavily, you know, empathetic and reaching. And I think that's, you know, they talk about maybe certain person leadership types really matching the times. And this is really a great fit for Biden at the moment, because if there was ever a time for the need for an empathetic leader to try to bridge some of these gaps we have and chasms politically and this partisan, hyper-partisanship that exists right now. But he has his work cut out for him for certain.
I mean, that's the other thing too. He does have his work cut out with him for him, given the number of issues that he even raised that he wanted to address within his inaugural speech that he made. And that makes me curious as to whether we're going to see something along the lines of what happened to President Obama, where a number of the policies that he suggested prior to being in the White House had to be walked back for pragmatic reasons. Do you see Biden facing a similar challenge here?
I think most presidents face that, because there's always this, you know, the rising expectations after you win an election, and everybody, you know, wants you to do everything, and the American public are notoriously impatient. So they kind of, you know, Biden's been in office, what, 2 weeks or 2 weeks and barely, and you have some people going, well, why hasn't he fixed everything yet? But, you know, realistically, I think, you know, there's limitations to what you can accomplish, because, you know, the U.S. president isn't a monarch, and it doesn't even have the power of a prime minister, you know, in a parliamentary country, you know, the lead party in parliament, and then you have the prime minister. Well, you can get all sorts of things through if you have the votes. You know, in the U.S., it's very different because Congress is very separate, and there is such a limited. And I'll tell you, there would have been a lot more walk back on Biden's policy ideas had we lost those two Senate seats in Georgia, because the Democrats only took control of the Senate here in January. And for a while, I mean, I think the expectation was that the Republicans were going to control the Senate, and McConnell would have blocked everything, or would have tried to. So I think there's more of an opportunity for Biden's policies to get through, but he certainly doesn't have carte blanche. I mean, it'd be different if he had 60 Democrats in the Senate and could just run through and wouldn't have to worry about filibusters and things. But so there will be a bit of walk back, but I think that's why Biden is trying to push and be very aggressive in these first 100 days, you know, doing another initiative every day. He's being very smart about this. Because, you know, political capital evaporates like water on a hot, sunny day. And you know, you want to use your political capital while you've got a nice pool of it. And the more you can accomplish, if you accomplish good things, and the public's looking for somebody to competently manage the COVID crisis, competently manage the economic crisis that we're facing, you know, competently try to deal with sort of the racial and the political issues that we're facing. And so to the extent that he's able to do any of those things, that's going to replenish his pool of political capital. And I think it's very important for him to, you know, for example, that $1.9 trillion stimulus package to address the COVID, that is a high priority. And I get the sense that the Democrats will push past a filibuster and ignore the Republicans and just push it through at 51 votes through reconciliation if the Republicans won't come along. And I don't think the Republicans will, because I think the Republican Party is in the midst of a sort of civil war within itself. And I think they're running so afraid of Donald Trump's base that, you know, even the ones who are reasonable and who would normally compromise, I think there's limits to what you can expect there. So that makes you walk back some things. But that just means that you just have to look for the areas where you can make progress. And you know, Biden's been using a lot of executive orders to reverse a lot of the the policies Trump put into place. So he's going to be accomplishing a lot. I think one of the keys is how effective will their communication be? Because I think one of the big weaknesses for Obama was he did not communicate as much or as frequently with the public and build support for the policies, like the Affordable Care Act and things, which the Republicans caricaturized, you know, miscaricaturized, you know, and hopefully Biden will have learned from that mistake, given he was in that administration.
Is it normal for a new administration to want to clear house in the case that we've kind of seen a Biden administration want to do with those key roles that are in cabinet?
Presidents always, you know, change their cabinet. I mean, unless you're somebody who, you know, maybe you inherited the presidency. So, you know, Harry Truman became president. John Kennedy became president when the presidents that they were vice president for died in office. So they oftentimes inherited cabinet members from them. And you know, some of them will keep some of them. But generally when you have, and certainly when you change parties, it is not surprising at all that there was a replacement. That's pretty normal. And, you know, I think what you're seeing is probably there was more of an attempt by the Trump people to install political appointees to try to disrupt or block activity within departments and lower level staffs, not at the cabinet level. And they're the ones that we're having to try to replace because they were just there to be saboteurs. They're not there to, you know, and you want, you know, Biden and his administration are wanting to bring back the career professionals and the experts, the people who aren't the political appointees, because they're the ones that have the knowledge and they're the ones who the previous administration wanted to sideline and get rid of because they weren't agreeing with, you know, when you're assigned, say, like if you're an environmental protection agency, Trump wanted to get rid of all the scientists that were supporting doing something about or protecting the environment, replacing with political industry appointees who were, you know, let's just get rid of, roll back all of the protections. So, you know, those are the types of people that you're trying to clear out. And I think Biden's already fired about 2,000 of them across the government. So, and that's an essential thing. And I think one of the challenges is there's been a lot of bleeding out of expertise during the Trump years. And I know from many colleagues of mine who were in government left because they voted with their feet because they couldn't put up with the, you know, what the administration was doing. And so we lost a lot of really good people. And then the people who were forced out by the political appointees that were stuck into these places. So, you know, I think building that back up, I mean, the State Department, in all honesty, the State Department, it's going to take probably a decade to repair the damage that was done by the Trump administration, just losing the expertise, the morale there. I mean, the morale there at State Department, when I visit with colleagues there, it was the lowest I'd ever seen. So, you know, like I said, you do damage to an institution or a bureaucracy, like it takes a while for it to recover. It doesn't just pop back instantly.
Yeah, that's sad to hear. Given the potential for the National Security Advisor and State and Secretary of State roles to overlap, work in sync, and even clash on policy making decisions, how have these roles been used differently across different administrations?
Well, the thing is, the National Security Advisor is the one post that is not, you don't have to get approved or ratified by the Senate to be in it. So it's literally anybody the president wants to put in there. But the National Security Advisor, when they're used properly, the whole reason for that position, and really Eisenhower used it for the first time really that much, and it's meant to be a coordinator. The National Security Advisor ideally is supposed to be an honest broker that reaches out across government and helps to bring in information from State Department or Defense Department or the intelligence community and bring it also that it's all on the table so that it can be heard, like everything can get a fair hearing so that when the president is you know, thinking about policy, that they can make the best decision based upon, you know, this fair, you know, balanced gathering of information so everything is on the table. And of course, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush's dad, he used the NSC like that. And Brent Scowcroft was a great example of a national security advisor. And we've, on the other hand, had presidents who haven't been interested in that, you know, gathering all that information. It's usually kind of goes back to when I talked to you about those presidents that are more black and white. You know, they already come in. You know, why do I want to hear if everything's right or wrong, true or false? I don't need you coming in and telling me I'm wrong. I don't need you coming in and clouding it. I want, you know, so they tend to get in people who manage the information so that it goes the way they want it to. And so W. Bush brought in Condi Rice, who's an absolutely terrible national security advisor. And it just became, you know, just another advocate pushing a policy line for the administration rather than being an honest broker. Now, you know, Trump had a number of different people in the NSC role. You know, I think General McMaster tried to be a little more like Brent Scowcroft and was trying to do that. But of course that annoyed Trump because he was disagreeing with what the administration was arguing because of the information. So of course that got McMaster fired. And then you get other people who are more like, you know, pushing an agenda, like Bolton or people like that. I think with Biden, you're going to go back to the more functional, the better version of the national security advisor, which is more the honest broker trying to facilitate communication facility. And that's what the national security advisor position was originally intended to be. And that just helps coordinate a lot of the main big foreign policy decision making often happens in National Security Council meetings with the president. So it really is an important role. So I think the shift back to that, and you know, the reality is all of these people like Blinken and the DOD people and others, they were junior people who participated in NSC meetings in their previous roles. So they know how the system is supposed to work and they're comfortable working with a system like that. So I think you'll see a much more effective policy. At least you're going to have much more considered policy. You might have some missteps, you know, every administration does, but it's at least going to be well considered, which will make a big shift from what happened the last 4 years.
In the last few weeks of the Trump administration, we saw a sort of turning a page on the relationship with Taiwan. The State Department's relationship was given no sort of limits on how it could interact with Taiwan officials and with Taiwan diplomats. I'm curious, is the new administration likely to roll back or roll with recent changes made by the Trump administration concerning the State Department's interactions with Taiwan?
I think what you're going to see, I think China is going to be one of the major challenges for the Biden administration. And probably if there was anywhere that some of these Trump initiatives, if there's some of the areas where those might be preserved or some of them preserved, I think China is one of those areas, because I think the greater support for Taiwan, I wouldn't expect to see rollbacks in the willingness to do weapon sales to Taiwan. I think the big concern is, this is a very sensitive issue with China, obviously. And we've kind of maintained, we're not going to open up direct diplomatic relations again. I mean, we were trying to live by the fiction of, you know, like a one China policy. And we're just kind of accepting that, you know, we're just saying we don't want this resolved through violence with Taiwan. But we're definitely going to be much more supportive of Taipei, trying to support them. I think the concern that certainly the Biden administration would have, I know it's a concern that I have as a security scholar, is if the Taiwanese move towards independence, I think that would actually provoke Chinese military response. From the US standpoint, I think if you're in the State Department, you have to recognize, okay, look, we can conduct our relations with Taiwan in a certain way, but we don't want to encourage or provide false encouragement for them to go too far, you know, because we need to maintain this balancing act, because Taiwan is not the only, you know, flashpoint with China, you know, because we have the South China Sea, the dispute over, you know, the militarization of that, the artificial islands that are being made, you know, whether it be Spratlys or elsewhere, you know, these illegal Chinese claims to, you know, to the territory in the water and down in the South China Sea. So, and then, you know, you've got potential conflicts with Japan over some of the islands, I mean, which we've already, you know, acknowledged that, you know, that falls under our U.S.-Japan security agreement to come to their defense. So, I mean, we're already, and there's not going to be a rollback on things like that. And I think you're still going to continue to see us sailing naval ships and flying aircraft through those disputed areas, because we're basically saying, asserting that there's freedom of navigation. This is international waters. We do not, and the international community as well does not respect or acknowledge claims that have already been determined in legal proceedings to be, you know, illegal. So, you know, nobody wants a shooting war. So, you know, but as we keep doing that, that just maintains that, and kind of at least maintains a bit of a status quo. But, you know, the where I would see a little bit of a rollback might be on the trade war stuff. I could see, because that was, I mean, most of Trump's trade war stuff was very counterproductive. And it hurt the U.S. economy more than it was hurting other places. So I think you'll see the Biden administration change some of those things. But, you know, there's areas where we need cooperation with China, you know, North Korea, other things. So, you know, you can't just go to a Cold War footing with China and expect making progress. And foreign policy is very important to Biden. So I think he will try to walk that line.
And you mentioned North Korea. How do you think the Biden administration is likely to navigate challenges with North Korea, given past approaches taken by the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations?
Well, I think we'll return to a bit more of a realistic approach, at least sort of realistic. I have my own criticisms of U.S. policy to North Korea, because, you know, it goes down to this question: is denuclearization of North Korea actually a realistic policy goal? Is that something that really is a possibility, or is that just kind of a pie in the sky thing? You know, and I think one of the problems with during the Obama administration, during the Clinton administration, was a lot of times negotiations with North Korea were conducted under, well, we will negotiate, but we're not going to make any concessions unless you agree to denuclearize, you know, give up your weapons. It's kind of like expecting the other side to completely capitulate before you even start. Whereas, you know, I think a more productive negotiating approach would be to build slowly, build confidence building measures and try to reduce tensions, much like happened during the Sunshine Policies and Kim Dae-jung back in the 90s. But, you know, I think Trump, unfortunately, he kind of demonstrated how not to conduct policy with North Korea, because he just gave away, you know, concessions after concession, giving state visits, doing all these sorts of things and getting nothing in return. Because they weren't listed, because, I mean, basically the North Koreans were wanting some sort of tangible thing back, like sanctions relief or things like that. Trump just wanted a PR success. And so, you know, that's why the North Koreans at the very tail end of the Trump administration, they said, we're not interested in another summit between you and Kim Jong-un, because, you know, we're not interested in becoming part of your PR sideshow. I mean, the North Koreans actually said that. Well, there, you know, there's not going to be any state visits with Biden, you know, and I think, you know, it comes down to, I think, you'll always have American leadership saying, we never will accept North Korea having nuclear weapons. Because if you don't say that, you open yourself up to political attack from everybody. Oh, well, you're in favor. The reality is North Korea is already a nuclear state. They probably have 80, maybe even 100 warheads by this point. And we can kind of pretend that, you know, that there's this fiction where they'll just, you know, we'll wave the magic wand and we'll turn back the clock. But I think that that genie is out of the bottle. And I think the real question, and I'll be looking to see whether the Biden administration adopts a little more realism about North Korea, about the policies of the possible rather than the impossible, you know, of, well, how do we manage the situation, let's get agreements to prevent expansion of arsenals. Let's start lowering the temperature. And eventually, if you can do that enough, then the nuclear issue won't be as critical. And we can, you know, down the road, maybe move towards denuclearization or something. But to expect that immediately is just so unrealistic. And my hope would be that the Biden administration would, you know, hold North Korea accountable for misbehavior and things like that, but be willing to engage and not just adopt this knee-jerk, well, we won't, you know, we don't want to reward bad behavior, not at all, you know, which is what you saw repeatedly across several past administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, which I felt was counterproductive to negotiation in the North. You got to work with the people across the table to negotiate. Otherwise, it's not a negotiation, you know.
So. Very interesting. I'm curious as well, how influential have former presidents been in the past when it comes to a new administration? And looking particularly at former President Obama being involved in matters concerning the new Biden administration, can you see something happening there or not so much?
Well, presidents have always reached back. I mean, nobody's going to be calling Donald Trump for advice. I can guarantee you that. But in normal administrations with normal predecessors, even when they've been of different parties, I mean, John Kennedy would call Dwight Eisenhower. Bill Clinton and spoke with Richard Nixon sometimes. So of course, you know, Biden and Obama are such close friends. And you have to realize that, I mean, the role Biden played for Obama was Obama didn't have foreign policy experience. He was much more domestic oriented. And so he relied on Biden for knowledge in that area. I think Biden is going to be interested in Obama's take probably more so when you get to domestic policy and politics and things like that. But I could see, you know, I could see them having conversations because, Biden is the sort of person who will reach out to try to get information or advice from whoever he thinks can be helpful. He'll probably reach out to Bill Clinton as well. Even George W. Bush at times, you know, it just depends. But I mean, I think you'll see some engagement. Now, how engaged? I mean, they're not going to be involved in day-to-day policy or anything like that. I think, you know, when you've seen examples of past presidents becoming more engaged, it's been when there's been some sort of crisis or some sort of situation where the former president maybe had some relationship with some. So, for example, during the Clinton administration, when we had the crisis with North Korea, Jimmy Carter was sent as an emissary to North Korea. And that was before we came up with the agreed framework and actually dealt with the North Korean nuclear program. I mean, they stopped reprocessing fuel rods, all of this stuff, clear until Bush declared them part of the axis of evil. they stopped that whole thing. I mean, we were talking about going to war with North Korea back in the mid-90s. But ex-President Carter was part of that initiative and then was used sort of as an emissary to kind of help us to begin opening negotiations with Kim Jong-il. So you've seen an example like that. Carter was involved in a couple of other things. Nixon was used a few times to be a go-between with Russia because he had developed relationships, you know, and he was very popular in Russia. Much more so than the U.S., ironically. So, you know, sometimes there's cases like that where, you know, you might be able to make use of the prestige of a past president to bring more gravitas to a negotiation or to a peace talk or something. But beyond those rare occasions, you'll generally see it be the Secretary of State running it or Biden himself running.
Yeah, very interesting. Hey, Professor Thomas Preston, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to have a chat with you. It's very interesting.
Well, I always enjoy talking. I just wish I could transport myself there and enjoy your nice summer weather, escape our snow here. You know, I wish I could be one of those migratory birds that would come live in New Zealand part of the year and here the other part of the year. And, so I love New Zealand. It was probably the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life, and I love the New Zealand people. You're such generous people. So I was so welcome when I lived there in Wellington. And, you know, thank you for bringing me onto your show.
That's us for another episode of Audacious Aotearoa. Thank you again for tuning in. If you haven't already, make sure that you check out our Facebook page and give us a good old like. Also, if you're watching or listening to us rather on Spotify or another platform, give us a follow. And stay true, stay safe, more content very soon. Ka kite.